सहनाभवतु सहनाभुनक्तु सहवीर्यंकरवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शांति 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 ॐ तत्सत्। Satsang.
It used to be that the hankara was associated with doing and knowing, and if that's resolving into Brahman, then I'm confused, how does that come out with doing Dharma? If Brahman isn't a doer and a knower and all that, how does that come into in relation to the chit and buddhi and the manas?
Okay, so the question is, once a person has knowledge or you recognize the hankara really is being replaced by the aham, in other words, your sense of self is now Brahman, then where's the room for the ahankara? Is it something like that? Well, let me go on, because I think I understand the question. The thing is, there's two orders of reality that are coexisting. There's the mitya, which is maya, which includes your body, mind, sense organs, the ahankara, based in ignorance, right? So as long as you, and then there's the atma. So there's this universe, and included, let me put it this way, there's this whole universe, this whole manifestation, infinite manifestation of knowledge that we call Ishwara, the whole maya upadhi. Upadhi means a conditioning agent. Included in, as part and parcel of Ishwara, is this body, mind, sense organs, right? This jiva upadhi is in fact just like a cell in the body of Ishwara. It's part of Ishwara. Because of beginningless ignorance, which is just built into the whole situation, because the body, mind, sense organs, the antakarana, the mind of the jiva is limited. Just because it's not limitless. It's limited by nature. And so the mind, which is sattva, which enjoys consciousness, reflects consciousness as though, will always, wherever the mind is, wherever the thought is, wherever the sukshma sharira is, the subtle body is, with five sense organs, including the sense of touch, pervading this physical body, there will always be conscious being. The mind is never separate from conscious being. So what would cause the mind to think, I am not the conscious being, because there's never a time that it's not the conscious being. That's because the mind is pure sattva, as the mind is awake, it enjoys consciousness. The subtle body, the subtle body pervading this physical body through the sense of touch, the body enjoys consciousness, because the five sense organs themselves are sattva. So you're not aware of your body all the time. Sometimes you're lost in your mind, or sometimes you're in conversation, sometimes you're reading, your focus is otherwise. But whenever you are aware of your body, it is an expression of conscious being. It is conscious being. So that's kind of the built-in ignorance. But from the ignorance to the ahankara, to the existence of the body, mind, sense organs, to the existence of the whole universe, from the standpoint of the jiva, right, that all of it is maya. From the standpoint of the jiva, the ahankara is just a product of ignorance, but the ajnanam itself is maya. Right? The ahankara is maya. The buddhi is maya. The body is maya. Ishwara is maya, the Ishwara upadhi. Mm. Ishwara upadhi is as much maya as the jiva upadhi. Mm. So when a person, so now, this Ishwara upadhi is what we call the experience of the Ishwara Upadhi. Upadhi means conditioning edgings. So the experience of this Ishwara Upadhi is the experience of empirical reality. It's got what we call Vyavaharika Satyam. Vyavaharika Satyam, Satyam means this order of reality is called Vyavahara. Vyavahara means it's empirical, it's shared. So I can't think it away, you know. Whereas subjective reality is called Pratibhasika. I can change that, right, because it's subjective. So when we gain knowledge, what is fundamentally Vyavahara, Ishwara's creation, is not going to go away, right? Because I didn't create it. It's not subjective. But what will go away is what is ever is subjective. Okay. So now, when that happens, it means what is born of ajnanam, when I'm free of that ajnanam, of that ignorance, that won't be there anymore. But it, only subjectively, the things that are going to go away are things that are subjective projections or understandings based in that ajnanam. The creation is not going to go away until this body-mind-sense organs runs out its prarabdha, the karmas that brought it here. So what that means is that my buddhi, which is also mitya, now has knowledge because it has differentiated me, the self, the atma, from the mitya buddhi. You know, it's like clay pot. It's differentiated me. And it recognizes the asangatvam, the totally untouchability, non-objectifiable nature. My nature is never touched and changed in any way. And that is me. So like when we do the meditation, I say, let the buddhi gently focus on me. And then just be yourself. So that you recognize there's the buddhi focusing on you, but you're not dependent on the focus of the buddhi. Because your consciousness, you're self-evident. You don't need the buddhi to be. The buddhi isn't adding anything to you at all. Nothing. But the buddhi, when it's focused on me from its own standpoint, I become totally dominant in that buddhi. But that doesn't change my self-evident nature. I don't require the buddhi to be focused on me for me to be my own experience. So when I say, be yourself, that is so, that little shift is so that you can recognize that no matter what is going on in this mitya maya creation, yourself is never covered in any way. It is always there, simultaneously present, along with the mitya. In fact, mitya has no being. The maya has no independent being apart from you, clay pot, apart from you in any way. So now, what happens, now that you have knowledge, when you think of yourself, the buddhi just goes to you, who you really are. Unless there's this habitual ignorance there that hangs on for a while. After that is gone, then you are you. You are the Atma, which is Brahman. The buddhi recognizes that. But then the ahankara is still functioning, but it's mitya. It's functioning as a mitya thing, just like this body is here, right? This body is still functioning, It depends upon me for its being, but I don't depend upon it. The mind is functioning. It totally depends upon me for its being, but I am a sangha. I am free from it. And so the ahankara is, because this body enjoys a conscious being, my mind enjoys it, then the mind says, you know, I'm thinking the body, from the standpoint of the body, it says, I'm walking to the store. Or from the standpoint of my emotions, it says, I am happy or I am sad. Because it, from its own standpoint, it enjoys conscious being. And so rather than change the language, like if I say, you know, oh, I'm so tired. I don't have any thought whatsoever that, oh, I have become tired. The Atma has now become tired. I don't have any self-recognition of me being tired, but I have a recognition of my body being tired, you know. Or say my mind is agitated. I have no sense. I have no sense means anybody who recognizes this. You have no sense of the Atma becoming agitated. The mind is agitated. But we just stop normally. We talk normally. Like, you don't want to say, my mind is agitated. I know I'm not really agitated, but my mind, you know, we don't bother. So you just talk normally, but you know that ahankara is mithya. You have no delusion. It's, but when you say that I'm going to the store, it's not that you've lost your knowledge. You're just talking within the language of vyavahara, of the empirical reality that we find ourselves in. The only time, actually, this is all beautifully written up, there's a few verses of this in Panchadashi, chapter 7. It's somewhere in the middle there. I mean, I could find it, but it's in chapter 7. Where, you know, he says that really the only time we're talking about me as Brahman is when you're teaching.
Why? Say that again?
If when you're teaching, or you're having satsang or discussion, then you talk about the reality of yourself as Brahman, and this is all Maya and Ishwara. But how? When else are you going to talk about that? But that's your knowledge, you know. But nobody has that knowledge except for you and your students, or you and your guru bhais, you know. And so that's when we're talking about the fact of who I actually am. But who you actually are is what you're living all the time. You know? But it's not a shared knowledge. It's a shared reality, but it's a reality that is covered with, as though covered with self-ignorance, until a person becomes a mukshu and says, well, who am I really? What is really going on here? Who is God? Is there a God? Why was I born? What am I doing here? Why did I take this birth? What happens to me when I die? Who am I really? All of these questions start to come. And at that time, then you can, you'll meet your teacher, so the Upanishads, the tradition says.
So,
and you're
so,
ready for it.
So this pramana brings knowledge to the mind and the buddhi.
To the buddhi.
To the buddhi. Well, what about the unconscious? Does the unconscious hear this as well?
Well, the...
Are the little ones inside hear this?
Everyone hears it. Mm-hmm. But say you have a five-year-old in the room, and you're trying to make them listen to Vedanta. Okay. They're probably playing around and doing everything else, unless they had some extraordinary birth, you know, like a little savant or something. Otherwise, they're playing with themselves, and this knowledge and everything is being heard in the unconscious, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But those little ones aren't being addressed.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want to teach them Vedanta, you have to teach them in their own language. Mm-hmm. You know, age-appropriate Vedanta. Like Swamiji sometimes teach little kids, you know, at the camps.
I used to go to those.
Oh, yeah, we sit there quietly in the back and just see,
yeah.
sees how he talks, these little ones, you know, and gives them things that they can appreciate and understand in their own age-appropriate way. You have to talk to your little ones like that, too. It's Vedanta's not the issue for them. The issue is they've been traumatized in this way, or their feelings have been badly hurt, you know, or they've been shamed. All these different things, emotions that are held, childhood emotions that are held inside. You know, and those can't be bypassed.
Mm-hmm. So even if you use the pramana that shines a light on your own nature that's whole, that light doesn't affect the unconscious. The unconscious has to be dealt with separately.
What it does is that the buddhi is the one that gains that knowledge.
Yeah.
And what it does that what is so useful is because the buddhi has knowledge.
Yeah.
And now you've learned how to be with the unconscious.
Yeah.
You know, the buddhi is yourself. It's a spokesperson for yourself. But you need to go into the unconscious and dialogue with those parts in order to heal them. Mm. You know. Mm.
So Vedanta is not designed to talk to them directly. It talks to the
buddhi who talks to them directly.
Hmm?
Yes. Hmm. And you don't really need Vedanta to do that inner child work.
Yeah.
It's very helpful.
Yeah.
But it's not necessary. I mean, I have lots of clients. I teach them all this inner friend, inner child work. You don't need Vedanta for it. But if you have Vedanta, then everything resolves into that. Because that's as far as you can go. That's the really the self of the inner friend is the Atma. The Atma is the self, is the inner friend, without any words. Okay, one second here. Jagadish. The connection to Ishwar Upadhi is always there, but the identity with the body-mind complex is very strong, as when there is physical pain in the body and only the jiva connected to one particular body knows that. So the ahankara and the identification to one body-mind complex will always be there, but known as mithya. That's true. That ahankara as mithya will always be there, because as long as the body is here, as long as the body is here, this body and the sukshma sharira, the mind is okay and awake, you know, and the subtle body is in this physical body, then the sense of self doesn't extend to the whole creation. It only extends up to the body. From the standpoint of the upadhi, from the standpoint of Brahman, of yourself, there is no creation. For the creation to be known, it requires the creation to be there. If that sounds weird, think of it like this. For a thought to be known, the thought has to be there, right? If the thought is not there, it's not known, right? So the thought, the knownness of the thought is only from the standpoint of the thought, the presence of the thought. So the knownness of the creation is only there from the standpoint of the creation. If the creation is not there, just the knownness, the self-evident Atma, the truth of it, is what is there, right? So this idea of the ahankara, yeah, it will always be there. If the body is from, this is what one thing Swamiji talked to me about, because with some of his, some of the things he went through, like when he was having that pacemaker put into his, that heart, they made a nick on the heart. And with that little nick, it started bleeding, and they had to open his chest right away. He told me that the pain was so excruciating. He said it was unimaginable. The pain was unimaginable that happened. And so he said like this, the pain was unbelievable. It was unimaginable. And he said, I almost lost my objectivity. He said it was almost too much. And that can happen, you know, because the body itself, with the kind of pain it produces, it can be overwhelming. But it'll be overwhelming while it's overwhelming. That's what the experience is going to be. That's possible. That didn't happen with him, but he said that it was very, very tough.
And what was the difference there? He didn't become overwhelmed. Because I was talking to somebody who studied Vedanta, and they said that they were overwhelmed. The Vedanta wasn't there and there for them.
At that time,
yeah. Yeah.
But that's all it is, at that time, because the buddhi wasn't strong enough. But when we say, I would say, remember, you know, when we talk about jnana nishtha, how Swamiji started talking about it as commitment to knowledge. Swamiji had that commitment. It was the unbelievable commitment to where it was not just a commitment. It was like the highest value of his buddhi.
He wouldn't quit that.
No.
So that,
and that's what he was trying to tell people. He had that value, you know, that commitment, just mm-hmm. incredible. So that like the matchbook, mm-hmm. it's like the matchbook. He would not like to see himself overwhelmed. You know,
surprise.
Even if it was, it would be nothing in terms of his knowledge. It's just that there was the overwhelming situation that happened. But Swamiji had this thing about not wanting something like that to happen. Yeah, he was amazing that way. So, let me see. The connection to Ishwar Upadhi is always there. Yes, it's always there. It's not even a connection. the body, mind, sense organs is not connected to the Ishvara Upadhi. It actually is the Ishvara Upadhi, part and parcel.
Wait, you know, what's the distinction you're making?
I'm saying that the jiva, the body, mind, sense organs, I know that Jagadish knows this, I'm just using this to kind of highlight something. If you say the connection to Ishvara Upadhi is always there, what I'm saying is it's not that you are not connected to the Ishvara Upadhi. There is nothing here but the Ishvara Upadhi. This body, mind, sense organs, your mind, every single thing that happens is just the Ishvara Upadhi. But because of Ajnanam, you take yourself to be in relationship to the Ishvara Upadhi. You're not really in relationship to the Ishvara Upadhi. This is the Ishvara Upadhi, you see. But because of Ajnanam, it's almost like I've entered into the Ishvara, and I'm a jiva here, and this is Ishvara out here. No, there's no jiva. There is no jiva. The jiva, whole idea of the jiva is ignorance. The ignorance is responsible for the idea of the jiva. There's only Atman, there's only Ishvara. So then he says, the connection to Ishvara Upadhi is always there, but the identity with the body-mind complex is very strong. True, it could not be stronger. Because from beginningless upadhis, jiva upadhis, beginningless. The mind, by its nature, always endures consciousness 100% like the clay pot. So why should that mind not take itself to be the self? You know? It has to be pointed out. When it's pointed out, then it's obvious. So then he says, but the identity with the body-mind complex is very strong, as when there is physical pain in the body, only the jiva connected to one particular body knows that, the truth. So the ahankara and the identification to one body-mind complex will always be there, but known as mitya. That's true. It will always be there, but it will be known as mitya. Only you can only call something mitya if you know the adhishtana. Mitya has no meaning at all without recognizing the adhishtana. The adhishtana is what is actually there. So you can't call the snake mitya. Say you're saying, oh, look at the mitya snake. It means nothing unless you see the rope. Then it means something. Otherwise, it's just a word. It means nothing. There's no knowledge involved in it. So if you say that something is mitya, like the ahankara, with its identification with the body is mitya, that's because you recognize the satyam of the atma, of yourself. That's what allows the ahankara to be mitya. Otherwise, the ahankara is not mitya, it's the aham. We call it ahankara because we're teaching. We call it I notion. But for an ajnani, it's not an I notion, it's who I am. We say, who you take yourself to be, that aham is an ahankara. It's the notion of yourself. It's a false, it's a misidentification of me with this body. It's called a mutual superimposition. And that's all, Jagadish. All pranams, okay, good. Danya. This is a question the person from Norway asked me today online, and I didn't know the answer to her question. Is consciousness, Brahman, aware of itself? Okay. Consciousness is aware of itself, not in any sort of subject-object way. That's why we don't say it like that. We say that consciousness it is self-evident. That means, yes, it's aware of itself, but not because there's any act of being aware of itself. It's because consciousness itself is self-evident, you know. And so when we say something, is it aware of itself, that shows some sort of reflexive, you know, relationship where I am aware of myself as though there's some sort of subject-object relationship there. Whereas I am aware of myself because I'm self-evident, not because there's subject-object relationship. So, good way to kind of see if those words are a little confusing, the difference between being aware of yourself and self-evident. It's just when we do the meditation or you do japa and you just recognize your own being, you just notice, am I aware of myself in any type of a subject-object way, or am I just self-shining? And you'll see, I'm just self-shining. There's no duality there in that self-evident nature, in my self-evident nature.
So it's its own nature to be...
self-evident.
Self-evident and aware that it's there.
It's aware that it's there without any action of being aware of it's there. That's what it's non-dual, because consciousness is consciousness. Mm-hmm. It's self-shining. We have two words we use. Svatasiddha means it's self-evident, and by that it means no pramana is necessary to light it up. You don't need the mind, you don't need the sense organs, nothing is needed to make it known. Whereas in the world, and even in terms of the world that you perceive through your sense organs, or the experience of the body, the mind, the sense organs, the thoughts, the moods, the emotions, the imaginations, meditative states, none of these are self-evident. They need the mind and or sense organs. Right? Without the mind, without a pramana, they're not available to be known. Whereas the self doesn't require the mind or the sense organs or any pramana. For the self doesn't require the mind or sense organs or any pramana for it to shine. So it's svata siddha. It's self-established, self-evident. Or sva means one's own. Sva prakasha, self-shining. Prakasha means light. It's its own light. So it doesn't need another light to bring it in, to light it up. So svaprakasha and svatasiddha. Those are the two important words.
And only the self is like this.
Yes, only. Because everything else is objectifiable. There can't be two selves, because the self isn't objectifiable to exist within time and space, just your own being. So there's only one of you, right? So there's not any other self that can come and light this self up. There's only one that it need not.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
How does the jnani see agency or volition? That kind of thing.
How does the jnani see agency or volition? We look at the buddhi as an instrument. It's a capacity that the buddhi has. You have such a thing as free will, even though it's limited. It's limited, very highly limited, by the prarabdha karma. But within the prarabdha karma, the karmas that, you know, from beginning to end, to have your life, within that prarabdha karma, the mind has the capacity to choose, to make choices, you know. Even though, as you analyze it, the things that you choose to do are highly, highly influenced by your prarabdha karma, to the point that there's really very little free will, and from one standpoint. But from another standpoint, even though the buddhi is highly influenced by the prarabdha, by your past, by cause and effect and all of these things, highly influenced, nevertheless, it has the ability to choose. Even though the choice that it makes is highly influenced, that muscle is still there. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And so we never say that the free will is unencumbered, because it's very much influenced by the prarabdha karma and all of your experiences and your assimilation of experience. You know, like you can make a lot of kind of go down the wrong road in terms of adharma, and then you'll be generating all kinds of karmapala from that, and you'll have to dig your way out. But all of it's still taking place within your prarabdha karma. Yeah. So we say there is free will and agency, though it's highly limited. You don't feel it's highly limited because you don't think, oh, I'm making this choice because this happened and this happened before that and this happened before that. And so this is the choice I'm forced to make You just think you're making this choice. Swamiji once said, really the real choice that you have is in prayer. Because somehow that, if you think it, it's really beautiful to say, think about, because there you're kind of going back to the source in a way. You know? And you're not just acting out. You're turning around. You know, so that's kind of interesting. So he won't say you don't have any free will. He'll say that it's there, but you, that doesn't mean it's not highly influenced.
When I was at the Arvada Hospital, the doctors, they were like, whatever's happening is
Ishwar.
The way, yeah. I mean, they were just so strong in it. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, blah, 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 this, blah, that. No. You know, there was no...
Because that's that thing where that we did in the meditation, there are no mistakes. There are no mistakes because the karma pala that you're experiencing, it's already all happened. It's already all, you know what I mean?
It's already happened.
It's already happened. And so this is the product. And so now the way we respond to that product can influence what happens next. Yeah. Especially as we learn from our mistakes in terms of dharma, adharma. And we do. The creation is built that way to keep burning. Like if you stick your hand in fire, they use that example. How many times are you going to do that? You will figure it out that this doesn't work, it's not going to work. You know.
But at the moment of choice, or at the time of preparing to make a choice, it doesn't feel at all like it's for... ordained in any way.
You know, but when you're making the thing, this is the thing. You're making a choice. Okay, so now you're doing an action which will then put into effect their own karma pala like that. But the one who's making the choice and the situation that you find yourself in to worry that you're going to make this choice now, that karma pala is already there. It's already happened. And so now, in this situation, you're going to make a choice. But now, see, in this situation, now that it's already happened, it's already here, you can say, you know, Bhagavan made a mistake. Bhagavan made a mistake. He did the wrong thing, and he put me into this awful situation.
Yeah.
And so Amaji will say, there are no mistakes. This is not a mistake. There are infinite, you know, cause and effects that come into play that create this situation. It can't be a mistake. You may have made a mistake, and you might say in hindsight that you made a mistake or somebody made a mistake somewhere. But in terms of the result, that's not a mistake. That result is the product of all of these cause and effects that have come into play to produce this.
So it's not by random then. I mean, it's not
Nothing's exactly random. It's just infinite. You know, infinite is as though random, because you can't possibly figure out what everything that was involved to create this particular product. But you can have Shraddha and Ishwar that this product is not a mistake, in that these are the infinite laws of the creation, you know, are at play here. And this is what is produced. So I've done this meditation a few times. It's one that Swamiji's done. You know, where you sit in front, you face each other, person, you and maybe your partner or somebody that you have a difficult relationship with. You sit there together facing each other. And then you kind of recollect everything that had all the cause and effects, to best of your knowledge, that have brought you into this situation, and then you think of your partner, whoever that is, and all of the things that have happened on your partner's side that have brought him or her to this situation, you know, and what has been produced. This is what has been produced. And when you realize that this emotion or this tension or whatever is a product, you know, and actually it's not a mistake, because all of these things have played into the production of this product, which is this tense, horrible emotion that you're suffering or whatever it is. And then when you see it like that, then you can offer the whole thing to Ishwara, because it's all Ishwara. The product is Ishwara. All the cause and effects that have gone into place. And then if you want to make a change, you know, that's a very prayerful thing to do. Also, you make a change, okay, I'm going to act in this way. And then you're setting off another chain of cause and effect, which is also not going to be a mistake. From Ishwara's standpoint, from your standpoint, you say, I shouldn't have done that.
Yeah,
right. Right. And that's probably true. That's like, oh, I shouldn't have put my hand in that fire. You know. But the product is not a mistake.
So like if I'm faced with like a pretty trivial, like what train to take, and I have to make that decision a month ahead, and I don't really know what the right one is, and then I'm kind of like a little bit suffering over that.
Yeah.
But is there a way to keep that philosophical?
Not worry so much about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you can just, because sometimes you have to make a choice. Usually, when it comes time to actually make a choice, when you have to make the choice, usually the choice is kind of obvious. Mm-hmm. You know, when it's actually the time to make a choice, the real time to make a choice, it's usually kind of makes itself. But then in later you can say, oh, if I would have done this, it would have been better. Yeah, but you know what? That's not what happened. Because that choice was not there at that time. So this is what you get. And it's not necessarily a mistake at all.
Like when I'm trying to make a certain choice that it's repetitive for me, like I'm trying to decide whether to go to Bali or whether to go to India and when to go and how long to stay, and you have to make these decisions quite a bit ahead. And I'm like kind of tortured over it. And then once it's made, then I don't think, oh, I could have made.
Then you, once it's made, you're fine.
Yeah. But that
you worry.
Yeah.
But how I deal with that, you know, that seems to work fine, is you don't know what choice you're going to make until the time is right.
That's right. That's
and so I just relax until I know what
so
I know.
So you absolutely have to make it, or when you feel
well, it's once there. Because a lot of times we just don't know. You can see you're going to have to make the choice. And that's the problem. You say, I see I'm going to have to make this choice. I'm going to have to make this choice. I'm going to have to make this choice. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. But that's because it's not time for you to know what to do. Sometimes you have to just be really patient. And sometimes in life you have to be patient for a really long time. It depends when you see things around the bend, you know. And you have no idea what's going to happen or what you should do or anything. You have no idea because you have no idea. You have no idea. So what are you going to do? You just have to say, I have no idea. And you don't need to have any idea. It's only because you see, you expect in the future that you'll need to know something. But you don't need to know it right now. So you start to live very much more in the moment.
In the moment.
In the moment, and not in a flippant way. It's that in the moment there are decisions to be made that are here now to be made, and those aren't a problem because everything is ripe. It's like the fruit is ripe. Yeah. But you learn to trust. You have to trust in Ishwara. Because otherwise, if there's no Ishwara for you, then you know, I am going to have to make this decision and I have no idea. You don't know that these decisions are going to come to you as part of your karma, the prarabdha karma. When it's time to make the decision, it will fall into place, and it's barely even a decision. But you have to be patient and have that trust. Mm-hmm. And then just make the decisions that are here to be made for you now. That's a very nice life. It makes life so nice because you can actually live here in the present, you know. And just let Ishwara take care of the future. Swamiji says that so profoundly. That is who he was. Yeah.
Still working on it.
Well, yeah.
But, you know, how do you explain to, like, a starving child born in Biafra or something like that? Does that actually come out of his karma,
that's hard to answer because of this, there is the karma would probably show astrologically that there's really some difficulty that child is being born into a really tumultuous time, difficult situation.
Yeah.
So there is that. And then they'll try to do pujas to try to mitigate that difficulty. And there is also abuse of free will. Yeah. Like somebody doesn't take a birth to be a murderer, for instance. They can take a birth in a very difficult family situation. But for them to be a murderer, they've not taken a birth to be a murderer like that. So there is such a thing as abuse of free will. So,
because to see that innocence there, born into trauma, is always a kind of a shock. And I would like to be able to fit it in with this definition of Ishwara to some extent, because it's still confusing.
Yeah, I know. It's.
But I'm not asking for some ideology or anything like that, but.
Well, I don't want to get too much. I want to answer these other questions. But let me say a few things about this, because it's a big topic.
Yeah.
In all of the religions of the world, this is the issue. You know? God is either not infinite, because he lets all of these bad things happen. So he's not omnipresent, omnipotent, you know? Or he's evil. Because he's omnipotent and omniscient, and he lets all these horrible things happen. So he's either weak, you know, and a good weak person, you know, or he's an omniscient evil person. So that's especially in Christianity and some of the Western religions, that's the big issue. But what if you look at Ishwara as an infinite expression with an infinite array of laws? How the Hindu will more look at it is because everything is there. Every continuum is there from heaven to hell. Take all of the polar opposites are there in extremes that exist within this infinite array. And so you need to stay on the good side of Bhagavan by following Dharma. Dharma is what protects you. There's another name for Bhagavan, for Ishwara, is Janardana. You know, the one who punishes, the one who's punishing. Rudra, the one who creates your tears, the one who dries up your tears.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And so you have this, in this creation of infinite array of all possibility, you know? You need to, as this very frail, fragile jiva, stay on the right side of the tracks and in terms of Dharma, and let Dharma protect you. That's how they look at it. And it's not that Ishwara is good or bad. The self of Ishwara is the Atma, is your own being, which is unbelievably indescribable in its wholeness and in its beauty. But this is an infinite manifestation of that self. It would be, think of it from the standpoint of Ishwara, as in when you start thinking of the earth and all of the planets and the infinite array of this creation, it's unimaginable, actually. You can think of it as an infinite, unimaginable mandala of sorts, something like that, you know?
Yeah.
And then within this infinite array, there are infinite numbers of laws, and we find ourselves contained within those laws. The Vedas will tell you, you know, which are what scriptures do, how to protect yourself in this creation in order to have the most happiness that you can get within duality. And it all is around Dharma. So Danya says, isn't it the buddhi which recognizes the self-evident nature of the self? The buddhi does recognize that, but the buddhi is mitya. The buddhi is not, it's differentiating itself from the self-evident nature of the self. It's recognizing that the self-evident nature of the self is actually independent of the buddhi. The buddhi itself realizes that. It realizes its own mityatva. It differentiates itself from the self-evident nature of the self. So really that's why we say that knowledge is ajnana nivritti, the elimination of ignorance, not the gain of a new experience. You recognize that your being is self-evident, that the buddhi is not contributing to that. So Jagadish says, so the cessation of suffering is only possible when the identification of any physical pain and emotional uncomfortability be very objective as part of Ishvara and known as mitya. The cessation of suffering, there will be the cessation of suffering in terms of the Maya Upadhi will continue as long as you have a body, mind, sense organs. I mean, your body is capable of physical pain, right, and emotional discomfort. Now, where there is a complete cessation of suffering is in the recognition of the self, which has never had any suffering. So in a sense, there's no cessation of suffering. There's the recognition of the one for whom there has never been any suffering, the one who by nature is free of suffering. So that means that for a jnani, as long as you have an upadhi, body, mind, sense organs, there will be definitely some sort of suffering or another in the upadhis, but there will not be any suffering in yourself.
Yeah.
Right? So two things are happening there. Two things are happening there. The recognition of myself is absolutely free from suffering, and the recognition and recognizing the suffering of the body or the mind as belonging to the body and mind, and doing whatever you can to help it. Mm-hmm. Like if your body is suffering, you want to take care of it and do what you can to relieve that pain, or to eat well or sleep well, to treat the body as a temple, really. And then if there's suffering in the mind, that's a great sadhana. Whenever there's suffering in the mind, then you should be with bring your knowledge to that and inner child work and all of that to help to take care of it. It's all about care in Dharma, inside and out. And you see it all as part of Ishvara. But just like that, just as a jiva within the creation, as a jnani within the creation, just like you want, how you want yourself to be treated is how you want to treat everyone else, and how you should want to treat your own inner beings and your own body. And so the identity of me as Atma is very important. Yeah, absolutely. The ahankara should now, instead of landing on the body, mind, sense organs as me, what happens is that the aham lands on me, on Brahman, on myself. That's it, yeah. It's very important. Because otherwise, there's still ajnanam. If I'm identified with my mind or something, or with an emotion, then that's my sadhana. It means that emotion has overwhelmed me, and, you know, that's okay. It's okay because it's a sadhana. That's how you have to look at it. Otherwise, that's not realistic also. Oh, I've heard this knowledge, now I'm supposed to be a great Mahatma. You've heard this, you gain this knowledge and then you work on it. You give the mind chance to grow and to mature in the light of your knowledge. It's very beautiful if you're not putting a lot of pressure on your mind. There's no need to, that pressure is not right. It's like putting that pressure on a little child to try to be something.
What do you mean by putting pressure?
Well, I'm supposed to be like this, or if I really had knowledge, I would be like acting like this or that. It's like not letting the flower unfold, not letting this knowledge take root in its natural, as a natural process, you know, pulling little petals off the flower.
But what you can do is accepting as prasad, and then prayer, and then once you give it to Ishvara, then the choice is hopefully clear. If we can't sort of control ourselves by force,
right? But you don't control yourself by force, but you be with the problems in a kind way. Like you say, if you have a child, you it doesn't work to be mean or forceful. That child won't grow well, you know. Or if they grow well, it's because of Bhagavan's protection. But if you're kind and patient and just want to help, then the child grows well and the buddhi unfolds well, and you know, the little ones inside and the problems, they work themselves out because you're supportive and caring. So a lot of damage that was done when you were little is something which is taking it, which you can redo now, right? It's like you can re-raise yourself. Bhagavan gave us these backup systems. So if somehow your family life is, well, certain things didn't go well, you have a backup system. You can redo it, the whole thing yourself internally. It's amazing. Thank goodness.
Yeah.
Most of us have had to redo a few things. I've had to redo my things, that's for sure. So it is. Thank gosh, thank God we can.
It's fun too.
It is fun. It's beautiful. Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, does that say I don't understand about the matches, Donna? You probably haven't heard that story. But that story is that Swamiji, one day he was just sitting at his desk, so the desk where you sit cross-legged on the floor, and he had this little desk there. And in the corner he had a book of matches, and he had learned how to take a book of matches with one hand and then fold one of the matchsticks over and light it with one hand.
This is a guy thing.
Definitely a guy thing.
And so he was showing us, I guess. I don't think I was there. He told me about it. He was showing some of us how to do it, and he went and he did it, and the whole book of matches blew up in his hand. Okay, that's okay. That's not the problem. The problem is that when the book of matches blew up in his hand, he went, oh! Like, and he was startled, and he did not like that he had been startled like that. He would rather that he just objectively handled the matches being lit up like that, you know. But it caught him off guard. He didn't like being caught off guard. So he told us the story. I wonder if I've told that story so many times, I don't even know if he knows I tell that story. I've told that story for years because it had an effect on me. I really liked it. He was talking about alertness. He used his own story as an example of alertness. You know? Of being alert. Because instead of the book of matches, it can be a type of thought, you know? Shama. A type of thought that comes that you're not alert enough to realize you don't want to follow that thought. You don't want it to have a life of its own. If you're alert, then you can catch that thought and not go with it.
And not be startled?
Well, not go with it, you know. Not let it take you down the primrose path, as they say. To decide, you have room to just make a choice. You didn't have room. Right? That's what he didn't like. There's no room to have shama or dhamma, you know? Just boom. He was startled by it.
Mm.
So that's not acceptable for him. All right, everybody. Is that it? Jagadish says, yes, Swamiji also had a wide range of emotions, but the unpleasant ones may have only been less than 1% of the time. Yeah, even 0.01%. Mm. Not that they weren't there, but he wouldn't catch them, you know. Anything could be passing through. He said once all kinds of silly thoughts could be passing through, but they're just passing through. I mean, it's like you don't catch on to everything that you see, you know. You can see all kinds of things, but you don't. So he would never catch on to anything that wasn't worthwhile. That's, again, alertness, having that, you know. Night, everybody. I'm going out the door. Have a beautiful evening. Om Tat Sat. Oh, we didn't say our prayer. We have to say our prayer. Okay, let's say. Om Swasti Prajapyah Paripalayantam Nyayena Margena Mahim Mahishaha Go Brahmane Bhyashubhamastu Nityam Loka Samasta Sukhino Bhavantu Kale Varshatu Parajanyaha Prithivi Sasya Shalini Desho Yamsho Barahitaha Brahmana santu nirbhayaha Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha Sarve santu niramayaha Sarve bhadrani pashyantu Ma kaschit dukha bhak bhavet Asato ma sadgamaya Tamaso ma jyotirgamaya Mrityorma amritangamaya Om Purnamadav Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Harihi Om. Om Tat Sat.
It's nice to hear the